to Radio Shalom. It's Deb Levy here coming to you from Planet FM. Shalom, everybody. We've just finished the Festival of Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, and it's been a really magical and special time in the Jewish community. We were thrilled to see so many members of the public join us to come and celebrate at Hanukkah in the Bays, our annual Hanukkah event. So if you didn't catch it this year, look out for us next December where we come together to celebrate the beautiful Festival of Lights in the beautiful city of Auckland, which, yeah, we feel really, really blessed to be a part of. And for today's show, I wanted to share with you a little bit about how I came to live here in Auckland and the connection that my family has with New Zealand, and to connect that to some interesting learnings and ideas that we can take away from the experiences of the Holocaust, the Shoah, as we call it. So when we're thinking about lights and the Festival of Lights that we've just been through, we've talked in the past about the different ways in which we remember. And light is a big part of that. And for Jewish people, every year on the anniversary of the death of someone who's passed away, who's close to us, we light a memorial candle, a Yahrzeit candle, to remember those who are no longer with us and to remember the light that they brought into the world. And so as we move from the lights of joy and happiness of Hanukkah into the lights of something a little bit more somber, I'd love to take a moment just to let our listeners think of anyone in their lives who they miss and that they are thinking of, because it's one of those things that, I heard a beautiful explanation, we don't really get past the losses that we have, but we do get better at pretending it's okay. So I just want to acknowledge for all those out there who miss someone who's close to them, their light is still here. We still benefit and enjoy everything that they brought to the world, and we still have their beautiful memories. And so when we have that time where we reflect on those that we've lost to keep that light alive, just thinking of you all and sharing together in the blessings that they brought into the world. So my journey to New Zealand started before I was born. My grandparents on my mother's side escaped from Nazi Germany and came across to New Zealand. And on my father's side, they escaped from Austria and came over after the Anschluss. And the reason they chose New Zealand? Well, they didn't actually choose New Zealand, so to speak. They really were looking for anywhere that they could escape to. For any of our listeners who aren't familiar with the history around the Holocaust and the Shoah, the situation in Europe was that as Hitler came to power and the Nazis came to rule, they started taking over different countries and parts of Europe. And in each place that they entered, one of the first things that they would do is make a series of laws that would take away the rights of the Jewish citizens that lived in that country. And for my grandparents living in Austria, the Anschluss, when the Germans marched into Austria and took over power there, signaled a dramatic change in their life there. So my grandfather had been working there as a barrister for many years. And my grandmother married him, and they had two young children, my auntie and my uncle. And my family still talk about the memories they have of that time, of that Anschluss. They were hiding in their apartment but looking through the windows, and they remember seeing the huge Nazi banners of the swastika that were draped on the apartment buildings opposite them, and they assumed on their apartment buildings as well. And tanks were rolling through the street. My auntie was a four-year-old girl at the time, and one of her earliest memories is she remembers seeing a protester, somebody who was against the Nazi occupation, running out into the street and standing in front of one of the tanks, and the tanks just rolled him over. And by the time it happened, it was too late for my grandmother to pull her away from the window, and that was one of the earliest memories that she had. The next day, my grandfather went into work, and his secretary of 13 years was sitting in her office chair, and she had a swastika on her arm, a band on her arm, band on her arm, and she told him that she was a Nazi and that she expected a pay rise, and there was nothing that my grandfather could do about it. shortly afterwards, of course, there were more laws restricting Jews that were brought into Austria. And so one of the consequences of that was that he lost his business altogether. But for the short time that he was able to keep his business, his secretary, who was openly a Nazi, took over much control of the office and of what was going on. And it was incredibly dangerous for my grandfather, because at that point they had started deporting Jews, and they were particularly focusing on adult males. And my grandmother was incredibly brave, and she hid my grandfather in the apartment, and she would go out and do the things they needed to do each day. So with the rations, trying to collect as much food as was possible, and also waiting each day in the visa lines to try and get a visa to any other country. And my grandmother had blonde hair and blue eyes, so she didn't fit the stereotype that the Nazis had of what a Jew should look like. And consequently, her papers weren't checked, and she was able to remain in the lines and often move around more easily than my grandfather would have been able to. And finally, after many, many days of waiting, my grandmother managed to get a visa just for a holiday to go to the UK. And they had a really difficult decision to make, which was whether they should go across via train or whether they should go across via plane. And Europe was already at war. It was incredibly dangerous to fly. And in general, the state of the planes, it wasn't what we have today, the safety features that we have today. So in general, flying was dangerous even without it being wartime conditions. But they were very aware that all the trains were regularly being stopped and checked. And very often at that time, the men would be taken off the trains and they would be arrested. And the family decided together that if something were to happen to them, they would rather it were to happen to them as a group. They didn't want to be separated, and so they chose to go by plane. And they flew across to the UK, and when they arrived in London, they met a family. They didn't even know them, but when the family heard their story and heard that they were coming out to New Zealand, they said, "Oh, we've got cousins in New Zealand. You know, we'll write to them and see if they can help you." And that their holiday visa that took them to UK, they also only had a holiday visa that would take them to New Zealand. And my grandmother, she had no idea about New Zealand. I mean, you understand this is in the days before the internet. And so there was no possibility to simply Google Auckland, New Zealand and find information about it. And so she thought it was a very primitive country, and she went out and bought a torch because she thought that she would be changing her baby's nappies in the dark in a tent, and she thought that she would need a torch in order to be able to see what she was doing. So actually they were quite pleasantly surprised when finally they arrived in New Zealand and found out that we did indeed have electricity, among other things. But at that point, this was where they thought they were going. And, you know, my grandmother, bless her, she had grown up as a princess, you know. She had had a very charmed life in Vienna. She'd had a lot of comfort. She'd gone from her father's home straight to living with her husband. So she was, you know, quite willing and ready to be the kind of pioneer she thought she'd have to be in New Zealand. And she was incredibly brave. I mean, this was a complete lifestyle change for them. And they didn't speak English. So they were coming to a completely foreign land where they didn't know anyone. They thought there was no electricity and they didn't speak English. But at that time, they saw the writing on the wall and they understood that there was no future for the Jews of Europe. And that if they wanted to live and if they wanted their children to live, their only option was to get as far away as possible. So they boarded the boat to come across to New Zealand. The journey took 6 weeks. And when they arrived in New Zealand, they were greeted by a family of heroes, the Morpeth family, who didn't know them But they just had strong Christian values and they believed it was up to them to do everything they could to help this family. And my grandmother, my grandfather, my auntie and my uncle, who, you know, my uncle was still a baby, they moved into the Morpeth's home and they cared for them and they looked after them. And they helped them get established, find work, find a place to live. And my grandparents joined the Jewish community here in Auckland as well. At that point, my grandparents were not religious. And I think their faith in God had been really shaken by the things that they'd seen in Europe. But it's not something that we spoke about much when I was a child. My grandparents passed away when I was young, so I didn't get the kind of adult relationship where you get to explore these kinds of existential issues in the same way you might with an adult grandparent-grandchild relationship. But I know for many of the Holocaust survivors who came out to New Zealand, one of the challenges and the battles that they had was with their faith. For some, it made their faith stronger. And for others, it really challenged their relationships with God and affected the way that they felt about being connected to religious Judaism. But for my grandparents, they made lots of Jewish friends here, both the other continentals who had escaped and kind of understood the journey that they'd been through, and the local New Zealanders as well. And they were blessed to find work and friends. And I know that life wasn't easy for them, but they were incredibly, incredibly grateful. And by the time my mother was born, she was the first Kiwi in the family. By the time my mother was born, she was brought up with the message that New Zealand was a place of refuge. And if it wasn't for New Zealand, none of us would be alive. And that it was up to us to be good citizens in New Zealand and give as much as we could back to New Zealand. And I've very much seen that model from my mother, and that she's passed on to the rest of the family, and also from my father, whose story I'd love to share with you as well. But that beautiful model of being a good citizen and giving what you can. And my mother always says, you know, there's a beautiful quote, we will pass this way but once, so any good that we can do, we should do it now. And that's very much something that came out of the ashes of the Holocaust, was that a real appreciation for every moment, every bit of time that we have, and also a real understanding that being here, whether here is on this earth or here in New Zealand, is not just about all the rights that we receive, but it's very much about the responsibilities that we have, and that it's so important to continue to give back because we are so blessed to be here. So that was how my mother's side of the family managed to survive Nazi Europe. My father's side of the family was in a different situation. My grandmother, she was living in a small village in Germany called Telheim, which is near Heilbronn. And it was a tiny village. The population of the village itself was a couple of thousand people. And of that, there was a population of 80 Jews. And the Jewish families that had been there had come 200 years previously. And they were mainly involved in agriculture and farming. And my family were the town butchers. That was my grandfather was a butcher, a kosher butcher. And interestingly, it wasn't just the local Jews who would buy the kosher meat. There were also other members of the village who weren't Jewish who would also buy his meat. And for all intents and purposes, the Jews of the village had a good relationship with the Germans in the village who weren't Jewish. And when the Nazis came to power, when Hitler came to power, and the rules and the laws in the village started to change, my grandparents decided that they needed to try and my great-grandparents decided that they needed to try and protect their children. And my grandmother was sent at that time as a nanny to work in England. and then became a cleaning lady there. And she was a young teenager when she left all alone. And her family remained behind. And I had the amazing opportunity to go to Telheim, to the village where my grandmother was from. And we had a lot of questions about what happened to my grandparents during the war. We had bits and pieces of the puzzle, and because the Nazis kept such meticulous records, in the end, the majority of our family was murdered in Auschwitz. And because of the records, we knew the dates that they died. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, the anniversary of a Jewish person's death is marked by a Yahrzeit. And so it's really important that you know what time of year that the person passed away so that you can light the memorial candle and say the memorial prayers and do what you can to elevate their souls. But other than these kinds of records, we really didn't know that much about what happened to the rest of the family. And when I got to Telheim, to the village there, I didn't speak much German, and I was trying to connect with the administration there to try and find out what I could about my family. And they managed to connect me with an amazing historian, Dieter Gahr, who has always had a passion for learning about the Jewish people. And he himself isn't Jewish, but he knows so much about the history of the Jews of the area. And he knew more about my family than I did. And it was an incredible experience because the first time I met him, sorry, I'm getting emotional talking about it. We walked into the Rathaus, the central town administration building, and he pulled out a photo of my great-grandfather that I'd never seen before, my grandmother's mother, her father. And he pulled out a family tree that traced back five generations from him to people that I didn't even know. And he had their birth, their death dates, their names. And then he was able to take me to the local cemetery and to see the graves of some of the family. And then I was blessed to be able to bring my father back to be able to say the memorial prayer, the Kaddish, at the grave of his great-grandmother. She wasn't deported to Auschwitz. She, a really sad story, actually. Some Nazis came to the village and beat up my grandparents. And after that, her mental health really suffered, and she never recovered from that. And so she ended up going to a mental institution, and that's where she passed away. While my great-grandfather was taken as a slave to work on the roads, to build the road connecting Telheim and the neighbouring village, which is a road that I have driven along. And after that, there were 8 remaining Jewish men who were still working on the road in Telheim, and ultimately they were deported to Auschwitz. And that was the last of the Jews of Telheim. And it was an incredible feeling to go back as one of the descendants and see the house where my family were in, and to be able to visit the cemetery, and to know that Hitler's plan was that I shouldn't have existed. The final solution was that all the Jews should be wiped out. And he had a good crack at it, but the fact that I'm alive today and other third generation and second generation survivors like me means that the plan did not succeed. So, yeah, incredibly blessed and lucky to be alive. So my grandmother, like I said, she escaped to England. And she was on a train in England, and she met a young Jewish man, and he took her details on the back of his cigarette pack, and she never thought she'd hear from him, but he got in touch with her, and it was a whirlwind romance between my grandmother and my grandfather. They fell in love, and the day that They'd been dating for a while and wanted to marry. But the day that England entered the war, my grandmother, as a German, became an enemy alien. And she would have been put in a camp, except that my grandfather picked her up from work at lunchtime. They both had their lunch break, took her to the nearest registry office, and they got married. Shortly after that, they started calling up men to fight for Her Majesty. And my grandfather knew that the chances of survival if he was in the army were very slim. He wasn't very confident with swimming and didn't want to go, and he got seasick as well, so he didn't want to go into the Navy. And so he enlisted in the Air Force, and he was a flying doctor. And my grandmother was already pregnant with my father. And in the end, my grandfather was stationed in the Middle East, where he was fighting and serving as a doctor. And my father was 4 years old before he got to meet his father. At the end of the war, my grandfather came back and, sorry, not four, he was a bit younger, but at the end of the war, my grandfather came back, and the first time that he met my dad cried because he wasn't used to having a man in the house. And after the war, my grandmother and grandfather decided that they wanted to get as far away from Europe as possible. And they moved out to New Zealand, to Whenuapai, to the air base there. My grandfather transferred and they started a new life here in New Zealand. And again, the message I got from them was very much born out of the ashes of war, which was to appreciate everything that we have and to be grateful for being in such a beautiful place as New Zealand. And recently, I've been rereading Man's Search for Meaning, a book by Viktor Frankl. Some of you may be familiar with Viktor Frankl, an incredibly famous psychologist, psychiatrist, and also a Holocaust survivor. And one of the things he talks about through his journey through the concentration camps is the role that suffering plays in people's lives. Because I look at my grandparents and I look at their friends, particularly those who survived the concentration camps, and I'm overwhelmed by the way in which they've responded to their suffering. For so many of them, they don't hold on to hatred and anger for what happened to them. They're filled with love and with light, and they move forward. And I saw that with my grandparents as well. You know, they'd lost so many family members. They'd seen horrific things. They'd had to start new lives, learn new languages, and yet there was no bitterness there. And when you start to understand some of the psychology of those who struggled in the camps, we can start to understand some of our own psychology as well in terms of how we deal with adversity. Viktor Frankl talks about the way in which suffering acts like a gas. So if it's in a room, it doesn't really matter what kind of suffering it is. It fills the whole room. It dissipates into the whole room. And he very generously says that in relation to any kind of suffering. And I say that generously because for those of us who are suffering in different types of ways, you know, we may feel uncomfortable to compare ourselves with Holocaust survivors or camp inmates who are suffering horrific things. But what Viktor Frankl explains is that any kind of suffering completely fills up your world in that moment. You know, even from the little, the mundane suffering, the suffering of, you know, being stuck in a queue or stuck in traffic, to the major sufferings that come with pain, like physical, medical pain, to the kind of suffering of being trapped, be it trapped in a situation or an incarceration, that at that moment, that suffering completely fills your entire being. But what he says, there is meaning and dignity in how you deal with that suffering. And he emphasizes that if you can bring meaning to that suffering, in a way it ceases to be suffering, or if it remains suffering, it becomes noble. There's meaning in it. And so one of the tools that he used when he was in the camps, and I don't even know if that time he would have considered it a tool, he was just surviving, was he would picture what it would be like, because he had been working as a doctor and psychiatrist before the war, so he pictured as what it would be like after the war to be standing in front of a group of students or to be standing in front of a group of other health professionals and teaching them all the things that he'd learnt in the camps. To be explaining to them the psychology of suffering and the psychology of incarceration and understanding the different ways in which people were responding to what they saw there. And by picturing that, he was able to transcend his suffering because it had meaning. Everything that he was experiencing, the horrors that he was seeing, had meaning because afterwards he would be able to use them to teach others in order to help those who were suffering. He also found meaning in looking after others in the camp, and he was open about the fact that he was a doctor, and he worked in barracks with those who were dying, and in very few cases those who were recovering, but in many cases it was palliative care. I mean, these people were going to die, and it was his job to just give the little bit of support and hope that he could. I mean, he talks about situations where he'd have 6 doses of medicine and 200 people that he was looking after and didn't know, you know, what to do about it. But the fact that he was looking after others gave meaning to his suffering as well. I think that when we consider the tragedies and the horrors of the Holocaust, of the Shoah, and we look at where we are today, it's so important to consider what we can take forward. And I've been blessed to work with and hear the stories of Bob and Frieda Narev, who are 2 Aucklanders, Holocaust survivors, who go around to schools and make sure that they use their experiences not to generate guilt about the past or to make people feel bad about the suffering that they've been through, but instead, what they do is promote messages to young people about how important it is not to be a bystander, to stand up when we see bullying or we see things that aren't okay. They understand that the discrimination and the horrors that they suffered happened because it starts with a little bit of bullying, a little bit of anti-Semitism, a little bit of racism. And if it's left unchecked, then it can grow into something bigger until it becomes something that's systemic and something that can be at such a large scale. So when they go into schools and they talk to young people, they aren't really targeting the bullied, and they aren't really targeting the bullies alone. They're really targeting those who stand witness and saying that for all of us, we can stand up and respond to those things. And I have to say, in the few times that I've experienced anti-Semitism in New Zealand, and thankfully they have been few, where I or somebody I love or has been targeted because of their race or religion, I'm overwhelmed by the response that other people have. You know, we're really blessed in New Zealand that we are not a country of bystanders. And if we see someone who's being treated badly, that often the voices that speak up against that will be much stronger than any voice of hatred. So I want to end today by saying a huge thank you to New Zealand, to the people of New Zealand. If not for the generosity, the kindness and the care that my grandparents experienced when they came to New Zealand, I wouldn't have been blessed to grow up in the country that I am so proud to call home. For those of you who are listening and feel like you can relate to that in terms of the culture that we have in New Zealand, it's a nice chance to be grateful. For those of you who are listening and haven't had that experience here, then my challenge to you is to go out and to make New Zealand the kind of place that you want to live in by giving back in the way that you wish people would give to you. Because one of the ways in which Viktor Frankl says we can find meaning in the challenging times is by supporting and giving to others. Thank you so much for listening to Radio Shalom. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Nature Bee. And if you'd like to tune in to hear this again, to share it with people, or to hear any of our other programs, please go to www.planetaudio.org.nz/Radio Shalom.